the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. I open up a public hearing on House Bill 601.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 601 allows relative caregiver with whom minor child lives to consent to medical treatment and educational services for minor child if, after reasonable efforts have been made, consent from legal parent or guardian cannot be obtained. Clarifies required information in relative caregiver affidavit and expiration of affidavit. Exempts relative caregiver acting in good faith who provides consent to medical treatment or educational services for minor child from criminal or civil liability. Declares emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. Is there anyone here who is prepared to speak on the amendment? Yes, please do. You remember, colleagues, we passed this bill actually out of committee, and then we brought it back to add an amendment that had been requested.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, I am Kristen Leonard here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And what I'd like to do is spend a minute or two to talk about the Dash 1 amendments that I think are before you. And to really thank you for the opportunity to revisit this bill. We appreciate the fact that it was already in front of your committee and very much appreciate the opportunity to talk about the Dash 1 amendments today. It is our understanding that the original intent of the bill and the immunity provision in the bill was to offer a protection for those caregivers, those relative caregivers, in their providing consent to any health care services, education services for a minor, protecting them from any lawsuits coming from a parent or guardian for offering the consent for that, for whatever that coverage or service was. Unfortunately, the way it came about in, you know, language in the bill, Section 3, Sub 7, extended, instead of focusing on the consent, it focused on the provision of that care. So the immunity language outlines immunity from liability to those caregivers providing health care services or providing education services. If anything were to happen in the case of negligence, abuse, something like that to this child where consent has been offered by a caregiver, the provider of the services are then immune from any liability. So the Dash ones, what they do is they circle back around and replace that Section 3, Sub 7, they replace it with really the focus on being the consent to get that care. That's where the immunity from liability lies.
Thank you. Any question of this presenter?
Excuse me.
Okay, seeing none. Thank you very
much,
Kristen. Okay, colleagues, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 601 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 601.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 4-29-13 into Senate Bill 601.
Representative Olson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 4-29-13 to Senate Bill 601. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move then that we move Senate Bill 601 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 601 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please. Debbie?
Aye.
Representative
Gilser?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Kinzmeyer?
Aye.
Representative Whitman?
Can I vote these bills?
No, no,
one at a time.
Excuse.
You voted for the Republicans are taking over the...
Which one?
Representative Whitman?
Aye.
Representative Whitman?
Gilser?
I already voted.
Whitman. Oh, I said excused. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Vice Chair Blomberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
The motion passes, and I will try once more to carry this bill on the floor. Thank you, colleagues. I will close the public or the work session on House Bill 601 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 991A.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 91A has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. It permits the landlord to require tenant to obtain and maintain renter's liability insurance, clarifies considerations and protections when evaluating applicants for tenancy, allows tenant to terminate tenancy with 60-day notice if tenant receives notice of foreclosure on rental property, establishes other technical revisions, including smoke alarms and carbon monoxide detectors, permits landlord to charge fees for noncompliance.
Thank you. We have several people signed up. John Van Landingham, Sean Miller, Sybil Hebb, and no, that's the second part. Yeah, just John Van, John and Sean, please.
Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 91A. It's the product of the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition, a clever name. It is to be distinguished from the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which you heard one bill and one disagreement earlier in the session. 3482 was that coalition's agreed-upon bill. HB 3007 was the issue that that coalition did not agree to. The coalitions operate the same way. I'm the facilitator for both, but there pretty much isn't any other crossover among the members. This particular coalition is older than the manufactured housing one. It started in the early 1980s, so that's more than 30 years. It's had a coalition bill in every session since, except 1991, when we agreed to focus just on affordable housing funding. Again, our process is to meet. I think at this time we met 13 times, meeting 14 times. The meetings are typically 3 hours long. We negotiate, we trade. It's a compromise. We don't get everything we want. We give up something we don't want to give up. If you pull out one piece, the whole thing may fall apart. With that background, I've given Regina an electronic copy of my written testimony, but also a paper copy if you are more comfortable with that. It's pretty detailed. One of the benefits of this coalition is that if we agree that we've made a mistake, we'll go back and fix it. So a big part of what's in this particular bill is what we call housekeeping, going back and cleaning up things that we or legislative council got wrong in previous sessions, or issues that we didn't think about and that we realize now need some clarification. Or I get calls and emails from lawyers all over the state saying, what in the world were you doing when you did that? And of course I feel bad and I try to fix those. For example, one of those is, what does midnight mean? Is midnight tonight? Is that midnight last night? And when you give a notice that says you got to do something by midnight, what does that mean? Oddly enough, the answer is not easy. But so we've tried to fix things like that. There are four bigger issues besides those housekeeping ones that are in this bill, and I'll briefly review them. I'd be glad to talk about them in more detail. The one that you may find somewhat controversial has to do with prior convictions, and I think that Sybil and Gwen are better able to answer that than me, but I can try if you want. So the four big issues that are in the bill, the first has to do with mandatory renter's liability insurance. It is not clear now that landlords can require tenants to obtain that. I could explain why if you really want to know, but just take my word for it that landlords are not sure they can do it, and they would like to be able to do it. Tenants are nervous about it because it can cost a fair amount of money, and some tenants, some low-income tenants, are not going to be able to get it. If you have auto insurance, you can probably tag on to your auto insurance, but some people don't have auto insurance. So the tenant perspective is, gosh, we're worried about whether everybody's going to be able to get that. Landlord's response is, this is probably only going to be charged in higher-end rentals, and that's an appropriate thing to do, and those people can't afford it. So that the market will cover it. What we've done here...
John, I'd like to ask you a question. So you're saying that they can require it, not that they must require it.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
What this will do is make it clear that landlords may require that if they wish. And it sets out some procedure. For an applicant, they've got to tell the applicant in writing in advance that they're going to require that. For an existing tenant, and they could do it with an existing tenant. Most apartment tenancies are month to month, and the landlord can change the rules on 30 days written notice. So in an existing tenant, a landlord could give written notice to the tenant saying, I am, from now on, I'm going to require that everybody have renter's liability insurance. And they will have essentially a 60-day period to get that, or the landlord can terminate their tenancy. We're requiring, as part of this compromise, that landlords also would have to have liability insurance because the tenants also may have claims. So it's sort of a tit-for-tat thing. If you're going to require that of the tenant can say to the landlord, you've got to have that also, and you've got to show proof either way. To address the concern about the income ability to afford it, we've said that a landlord whose tenants are at 50% of adjusted median income or less cannot require it. We've also said that if they're in subsidized housing, they cannot require it. So we believe that the market for this is higher-end housing. So that's not going to be impacted by people at 50% of adjusted median income. It's not going to be impacted by people in subsidized housing. So those are some of the protections that we've outlined in the compromise on that issue. The second big issue has to do with fees. The Oregon law currently severely restricts a landlord's ability to charge fees. The focus is we would like the landlords to take costs out of deposits. There's no limit, no cap on deposits in Oregon. A landlord can charge however much he or she wishes as a deposit. But a deposit is refundable. The landlord at the end of the tenancy has to account for it and either give it back to you or explain why the landlord took money out of it. We had some concerns. Tenants had concerns previously that some landlords were charging fees for a lot of things that weren't appropriate and treating that as a revenue source. So the legislature, two sessions ago, I believe, in 2009, severely limited how many fees and for what purposes and what amount a landlord could charge. There are some statutory fees like an NSF check, tampering with a smoke detector, those are different. But if you charge a fee for breaking a rule, there's a $50 cap on that fee. It has to be in the rent agreement. Landlords wanted to be able to charge more fees for noncompliance. And the two in particular they were concerned about had to do with tenants who brought down unauthorized pets. That has ramifications for other tenants. And tenants who smoke when the landlord has rules saying prohibiting smoking on the premises. That also impacts other tenants. So we've agreed to add those two fees. We've also agreed, landlords want to be able to give some incentive. And in particular, one of the more active landlords in our group who leads the group that Sean represents rents to a lot of people who are students at the University of Oregon. And he has the view these days that a lot of those people don't really get impacted by a $50 fee. They've got enough money, so that doesn't make a dent on them. So what we've done is what we're calling stair-stepping a fee. For the first violation, the landlord has to give a written warning notice saying, you do this again, I'm going to fine you. I'm going to impose a fee. Second, $50. Third, $50 plus 5% of the rent. So for higher-end rentals, that's going to be a significant fee at that point. We've also built in some protections for tenants in that the warning notice is a protection for a tenant. We've also said that the landlord can't take those fees out of subsequent rent payments, which is a big deal to tenants, because when the landlord does that, it makes that rent payment partial and late, and there's often a late fee. So it sort of cascade into paying more and more fees with that. The third issue, let me skip the prior history because that's a more complicated one. The third issue has to do with something we call early termination. So I know I'm going fast, and if I'm going too fast, you're welcome to yell at me, but I don't want to bore you. So the third issue is early termination and foreclosure. The legislature has already addressed some of these things. So that we already require a landlord who is in foreclosure when the tenancy begins to tell the tenant that in writing. Sometimes they don't. There's a penalty for that in a different statute. We're not messing with that in this bill. There's also a provision that you all adopted that says that if a property becomes in foreclosure, a rental property, during the tenancy, the tenant can give written notice to the landlord and apply the deposit or any last month's rent deposit to the current rent under the assumption that that tenant's probably not going to get that deposit back at the end of the tenancy. Because the landlord's not paying the mortgage and it's probably in financial difficulty. This bill would extend that to say that if it's a fixed-term tenancy, a lot of students are in fixed-term, nine-month tenancies. If it's a fixed-term tenancy and it goes into foreclosure, the tenant will get a notice under the foreclosure laws of the state of Oregon. The tenant will get a notice. The tenant can terminate that fixed-term tenancy early by giving a 60-day notice. The landlord can, in both cases, the this one and the idea of applying the deposit, the landlord can rebut that by providing evidence to the tenant showing that the landlord is no longer in foreclosure. Or a trustee could do that. And apartment buildings often, when they go into foreclosure, a trustee will take over and run it as usual. It's more common to be a problem with single-family homes that are in rental. The last big issue, and then there's a bunch of housekeeping things that I'm not going to talk about unless you ask about them. But the last big area is the idea of prior history, and it's number 5 in my memo. And we're doing sort of two related things here. There already is a statute that says a landlord cannot, in considering an applicant, cannot consider whether the tenant, the applicant, has previously been in an eviction lawsuit that was not decided adverse to the tenant. Most eviction lawsuits are dismissed. The tenant doesn't show up, and the landlord gets judgment. The tenant doesn't show up because it's non-payment of rent. There's no defense. They go by default. So in those cases, what we've said previously is that a landlord can't consider that, hold that against the applicant. This will extend this to say that in evictions where the tenant lost, where the tenant contested and lost, there was a judgment against the tenant, a landlord can't consider it if it's more than 5 years old. It also says a landlord cannot consider, with regard to an applicant, arrests. Unless the arrest led to a conviction or is still in process, because there is no resolution of that case yet. But just the fact that there were arrests can't be used against the tenant in analyzing the applicant. The third part of this, the part that's more controversial and that you will hear opposition to from one of our three, there are three landlord groups, three big landlord groups in the coalition. Two support this, one does not. The third has to do with convictions. There's not a time limit here. There's not. We talked about this a lot. There's actually a lot of movement in this area nationally about convictions. There's a lot of concern about how do you house ex-offenders so that they don't feel compelled to commit more crimes, if that is likely. We discuss this at length in trying to find different ways. And what we've come up with is to say that a landlord can consider convictions that relate to these broad areas. We talked about specifying by statute, but there are hundreds of criminal statutes in Oregon law. Hundreds. That list would not be helpful to anybody, either side, either in listing those that you could consider or those that you couldn't consider. I mean, we talked about concepts like you couldn't consider the fact that someone was arrested or convicted for sleeping on a sidewalk, for being homeless. Okay? But just using those citations won't help anything. So we've used these broad categories, and we've got the catch-all at the end. Any conduct that would reflect on or threaten the safety or the property of the landlord or other tenants. What we're trying to get at is an individualized analysis where the landlord doesn't simply say, okay, you've got a conviction, I'm not going to consider you. But instead, the landlord looks at the conviction and says, what's the conviction for? Doesn't matter how old it is. But what's the conviction for? Is it something that I think would make you a bad tenant? It's a pretty simple concept. Maybe we could make it tighter. But this is the best we thought we could do. And it really does reflect a compromise by both sides. So I'll stop there.
Any questions? Representative Kennegar.
Thank you. I have a quick question on the drug-related offense as one of the possible conviction areas. Does that include alcohol, like DUIs?
What does it say?
It just says a drug-related crime.
A drug-related crime? We didn't define drug-related.
Okay.
But I think that, as a law, I'm sorry, I didn't, Madam Chair, Representative Kennegar, I forgot my manners. I don't do criminal law, but I would guess that drunk driving is not a drug-related crime. But I think it could fall into the health, safety, or right of peaceful enjoyment of the tenants. Again, we're not trying to specifically say, for example, it doesn't say that you can't consider somebody's credit history. It doesn't say that you can't consider criminal convictions. It says that you can consider them if they relate to these broad things. I mean, from the tenant perspective, frankly, we're worried that we haven't excluded anything. But this is our effort to try to address that.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Rental Housing Association, the statewide landlord association, in support of Senate Bill 91. And as John indicated, this is a group, the coalition, that's been in place for many years. I first started working with the group in 1995, and they've obviously passed a coalition bill ever since. And I'm amazed, because this is one of the few groups that voluntarily meets in the interim to discuss these issues, to try to make your job a little easier. And I know many of you on here that deal with a lot of very difficult, tough issues. Landlord-tenant issues are no different. They are very controversial on both sides, and we voluntarily try to meet and come up with those compromises and that give and take. And I know many of you often have to make groups, lock them in a room to do that, and we do it voluntarily. So we are in support of the bill, and you know, as John indicated, you know, if you look at all these issues, or take one issue, I will probably have members that don't like the prior history issues. But I can tell you, though, that we heard loud and clear that we, if you look at number two on the fee issues, the biggest issue that we wanted to get and accomplish from this bill is the ability to add these non-compliance fees. It is a tool to get tenants in compliance. The alternative is eviction. And so, again, you have the eviction tool, you have non-compliance tools, and so for fees. And we believe having this tool is an important tool, and it's something, you know, dealing with repeat non-compliance and the ability to assess some of these new fees, it was very important to my group. And so, again, the give and take on the particular bill, we feel obviously getting the fees in this bill accomplishes that. And again, I know there is some opposition on other parts of the bill, but the bill as a whole is one of those things that was carefully negotiated, and we would support the bill. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'd just ask that you move the bill, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Sean. Any questions of either of these? Thank you,
Madam
so
Chair,
much.
Could I add one short
yes,
note?
Of course.
The bill passed the Senate 27-1.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Now we have Cindy Robert, Amy Stevens, and Jim Herman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the Rental Housing Association of Greater Portland. I have about 1,700 members, and I did participate in every one of the Landlord-Tenant Coalition meetings during the interim. Those meetings were masterfully run by John Van Landingham. Could not be a better convener of opposite sides, who really helped us get to some good discussions and some conclusions that were good for everyone but us. We are the only group who, in the end, was not supportive of the bill that came from the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and I want to tell you why. The one issue that we felt very strongly about was our ability to use criminal history in deciding who's living in our homes. We object to the prohibition, any kind of limitation on what we can consider when we're deciding who to rent to. Now, the bill does say that you can consider person crimes and drug crimes and financial fraud, but where does that repeat drunk driver fall? Where does the disorderly conduct criminal fall? How about those crimes that were plea bargained down to something lesser, but still the activities were offensive and ones that we don't want in our homes? Understand that 80% of my 1,700 members have 10 units or less. They don't have property managers, and they don't usually live on the site. They don't know what's going on there. They're often single-family homes where the people are left to their own accord, and my members would like to know who is living there, and they use the criminal history check to determine if they're making a good decision about who to rent to. My landlords don't have attorneys to help them in that process, so even though this bill says, oh, you can consider whatever you'd like as long as it's going to affect the safety and welfare of the other folks in the building, that leaves a big gray area. It says you can consider other things if you can prove in a court of law that you made that decision based on important knowledge. My folks don't have lawyers to help them do that work. So I have been doing this for 23 years, lobbying. And I know when a coalition like this gets together, it's very hard to think, wow, all these groups agree. This one group doesn't agree. So I understand. And I even asked my group today, I said, you know, put yourself in a legislator's position. All the groups support it. We're the only ones who oppose that. And I understand that this bill is likely to go forward. So I want to take this opportunity to make a simple request of all of you. As this committee ponders bills this session, in the interim, and next session, I really appreciate it if you keep in mind that not all landlords have 100 units, are making big profits, have property managers, lawyers, and other professionals to help them. Some are just small business people who are trying to make a living. They are the leasing agent, the property manager, the landscaper, the fix-it guy, and they have to defend themselves in court. They, again, 80% of my members have less than 10 units, and they often purchase those properties to simply help them make a decent living, to help them with their retirement, to help them be good people, to have their own small business. I ask you to remember that, and to keep in mind that in this economy, we should be giving small business people all the help we can. We should not be taking away tools that they use to make good business decisions, and that's how we view this bill. Understand as well that none of the benefits that you've heard about in the bill that other landlords think are a good idea have any interest to us. This is the one thing that we care about.
Thank you, Cindy. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Amy Stevens, and I am a small landlord. My mother and I have one single family house in Oregon City, and the only part of this bill that I have any concern about is, I think it's Section 3, Item E, and it's that catch-all. That makes me very nervous. I can follow any rules if I know what they are, but trying to decide what in someone else's view would be a crime that may or may not hurt the landlord or other tenants, that's just such a huge gray area. And we've already faced some legal action, and it's very difficult and very expensive. And with the one single unit, I would rather have very specific rules about that. I know it would take a lot of time to list out ordinances, but I don't think a law is an area that there should be a lot of gray area.
Thank you, Amy. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm a small landlord, and also I was a member. My name is Jim Herman. I was also a member of the Landlord-Tenant Committee Coalition this year, and my feeling is it's a committee process that's gone bad. There was no real give and take here on this issue. And think about it. If you were a renter or if you were a small landlord, would you like to be living next door to a convict? When I talk to members that I know in the ORHA, they're not in favor of this. When I talk to tenants, no tenant I've talked to or I have is in favor of something like this. Even Betty Dominguez from Home Forward and Jean DeMasters from Human Solutions, both in the Gresham area, have to live and work in the Rockwood area, which has a high per capita rate of ex-felons. They also expressed opposition to this in a public stakeholders meeting in the city of Gresham. So this is not really just a landlord issue. It is a tenant issue. And there is a huge disconnect between people that live in properties and their representatives. Also, the small landlord is very handicapped. They have a very limited ability to monitor what goes on in their units, and there's also an element of babysitting. You have to hold these people's hands often. We have families. We'd like to be able to spend time with those families. It takes time over holidays, late hours after midnight. It all ups our babysitting demands. Also, I wanted to mention something about the eviction tool. It's never fast enough. And it's the tenants themselves that pay the biggest price when they're living next to somebody that is maybe not on their medication, maybe for whatever reason holds a grudge. And when you find retaliation, it's usually one tenant retaliating against the next. In addition, every single time there's another nail in the coffin of affordability or time, there's a diminished inventory. People are fed up with all of the demands placed on the personal time. More individuals are selling out. And that's really what I wanted to express. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. Any questions of either of these? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you all being here, and I appreciate the outline that Cindy is it Robert or Roberts?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliams, it's Robert.
And I want to be sensitive to the size of your particular group and association. Was there any discussion about carving out smaller landlords in any of the coalition discussions?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, no. We've always gone into landlord-tenant coalition working as wholes, all the landlords, all the tenants. So there was never any talk about that. But I do want to tell you why it makes sense, not just on the criminal history piece, but also on, say, the fees piece, that the other landlord groups were so likable and wanted this bill and were willing to do all this. Even Sean said, you know, some of my members don't like this, but we were willing to do the criminal history part, but we were willing to do it because of the fees that we can now charge for pets and smoking. Again, going back to that, 80% have less than 10 units. They're not there, and they don't have property managers. They don't know who's smoking, and they don't know who's got pets that aren't supposed to. They're not there, and they certainly don't want to set up a system where tenants are having to rat on each other. That's not an environment they want. So there's never been a talk about a carve-out for size. We all are trying to put together a bill that affects everyone equally. Good idea, though.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy, I guess, or Amy, you can chip in on this too, I think. So I'm looking at Section 3, subsection 3, and I'm looking at the list there of the different types of crimes that would, or I guess the eligibility ones for criminal history. I would think, from what I remember, most of the crimes that seem to surface in that in a landlord-tenant environment, the units, you're dealing with domestic violence, but that's going to be your person crime. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to be dealing with probably harassment and disorderly conduct. And those are, I mean, depending on how you want to look at them, I mean, they're governmental type crimes. So then I guess going into sub E or any other crime mm-hmm. of conduct, I would think that you would be able to bridge what those crimes in itself would be if in fact it had impact on the facility.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like, I mean, like everything's there.
It does. Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, it does seem like everything's there, and it looks really good when you first read it. But here's a couple of issues that we have problems with. First of all, let's say person crime. Well, you, being once in law enforcement, I'm sure you know there's many times where rape is pled down to something else, where a domestic violence is all of a sudden just disturbing the peace as people plead down. And on top of that, you could be arrested 10 times for any crime, and as long as you weren't convicted of it, it doesn't count under this background check. Second piece you bring up, seems like it would be the catch-all. It seems to say, gee, anything you, landlord, decide is a problem, you can go ahead and use that. The problem is it builds a gray area, and I tried to get the group to reverse the language so the gray area was not on the landlord, but on the tenant. I wanted the language to say, you cannot consider these crimes. Instead, it says you may consider this or this, but on that second one, on the sub E that you're talking about, what you end up saying to the landlord is, gosh, why don't you go ahead and gamble? You decide you're going to take this crime into account on this applicant, and then they're going to sue you. That's what sub E does. It sets up a gray area where all of a sudden my landlords have to defend the decisions they make because they're not clearly stated. If this language had been written very clearly, landlord, you may not consider A, B, C, D, E, F, we'd be much better off. But it's not written that way. And we did ask for it to be written that way, and I have emails where I suggested that language.
Madam Chair, just okay, so I've named two of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, harassment and disorderly conduct. Can you mention a few others that you were thinking of?
Well, first of all, the drunk driving one is not in here. So the repeat person who's doing drinking and driving, who may in fact be leaving in the parking lot at a small unit doing the same thing. Originally, one of our concerns was the person who had been convicted of mail fraud, who was there stealing mail from the landlord's, the tenant, other tenant boxes, but they took that out. Some of my other concerns were things like you said, disorderly conduct. Is that a person crime? Is that a property crime?
Yeah, it's governmental. Right?
It's a governmental crime. So that's not in here. So, and then again, what about those crimes that are pleaded down to something different than what the action is? And the action is what we want to know about.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? All right.
Thank you so much.
Now we have Sybil Head and Gwen Baldwin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here in support of Senate Bill 91A, and very much appreciate your time and attention. I wanted to focus my comments. We're supportive of all aspects of the bill. I wanted to focus my comments on the Section 3, because that's where most of the discussion has been. And Section 3 sort of loosely falls into three categories. One is related to arrest history, one is related to prior eviction history, and the other is related to prior conviction history. With respect to prior arrest history. The general concept there is that arrests without attendant charges or convictions are not indicative of a person's guilt, and so they ought not to be considered in making a determination. The concept related to, and I don't believe there's controversy over that from anybody, the concept related to prior eviction history is important to tenants because it removes a barrier to housing, safe and stable housing, for tenants and their families. And the concept there is that evictions that were resolved in the tenant's favor or that did not have a resolution ought not to be considered at all. And evictions that resulted in a negative determination against a tenant ought to have some window after which they are no longer considered relevant. A landlord may still seek a specific window of good rental history, may still do a credit check, may still do a reference check, may still do all of that analysis. But if a tenancy, an eviction has been decided against the tenant, once it is 5 years old, it is no longer to be determined. I'll move to the concept of prior conviction analysis. And all the theme here, all of these themes are to make sure that there is a fair analysis of a tenant's ability to be a good tenant and to fit into the housing complex in a way that is safe and reliable and appropriate. And we are unfortunately aware in this country that there is a significant bias in some of our arrest and conviction histories, and that has led to many fair housing claims in other states. And as a result of that, there have been provisions put into place in several states, and that's also echoed in some of the employment analysis that the EEOC has put together that has created a principle that an employee's background ought to be assessed with respect to criminal history related to whether or not that criminal history has an impact on that applicant's ability to do the job well, whether that history is related to the job. This is a similar analysis that we're putting into this that bill, which is basically consider the history and determine whether or not it makes an impact on the tenant's ability to be a good tenant. And that individualized assessment is something that's really important to our families' abilities to be safe and stable, and it has a huge impact on our communities if people are able to access housing. A lot of this came from a concern or comes from a concern related to people moving out of homelessness into housing, and often those populations struggle with convictions related to sidewalk ordinances, traffic violations, disorderly conduct sometimes open container, things like that can really create a bar to a person's ability to get into a safe place to live, but shouldn't have anything to do with whether or not they are able to be a safe and appropriate tenant. Just a couple of points in response to some of the concerns that were raised. Number one, we've created specific categories that landlords may specifically use to deny an applicant, and we went through that list. Sex crimes, drug crimes, person crimes, financial crimes, including identity theft and financial fraud. The other category is meant to echo the EEOC standard, which is to allow the landlord to look at the facts and give an individualized assessment. So the concern was raised about DUI. And there is some gray area there, but that's purposeful and intentional because it's meant to be encouraging of an individualized assessment. So a DUI that was 20 years old for an applicant that is moving into a single-family residence, I would say that doesn't fit the criteria. If there are repeat DUIs and there's parking and a person is going to be using a car in the vicinity of other tenants and in the community areas, then I think that clearly meets the standard. So these are cases where the landlord will have to make a determination and make an analysis. That's what we intend. There is no damage provision for a landlord who violates these standards. So we've tried to do our best to be fair and preserve the balance of allowing the landlord to make an assessment, but allowing the tenant to have a shot at fair housing and safe and affordable housing when their background is not relevant to whether or not they can be a good tenant. The other things that I would just raise is that, again, with respect to criminal history, landlords can still check references. So if a person has been a previously bad tenant, they can certainly deny on that basis. They can still check credit history. So if there are outstanding judgments as a result of a conviction, they could use that in their analysis. And they can still do a screening on those bases. The other points that I wanted to make were, is that this standard is a defense for a landlord in any kind of a fair housing claim. So as these cases are coming forward across the nation, it's difficult for landlords sometimes to defend. If they're using a standard that's put into the statute that specifically allows them to use criminal conviction history, as long as they're using that standard, then that's something that's helpful to them in those kinds of cases. I would add that the Community Alliance of Tenants, which is a statewide but largely metro area focused tenant helpline, answers thousands of hotline calls from tenants across the state, and they have looked at this from the tenant perspective and are supportive of the bill and specifically of this provision. This particular provision was one of their highest priorities in moving forward this session for the bill. So there's definitely tenant support, advocate support for the bill, I think that winds up all of the points I wanted to make, unless there are questions.
Thank you, Sybil. Any questions? Representative Wissett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Hebb. You said there's no damages involved in this agreement, coalition agreement. So if I just don't feel good about you, then can I say I'm not going to rent it to you? Do I have to give you a justification for why I'm not renting?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnant, what I meant to say is that for this particular, for the criminal history and the prior history for Section 3, there is no penalty for a landlord who fails to apply that section correctly. To answer what may be your broader question, I'll turn it over to Mr. Gannon.
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnant, I'm asserting myself just because I've done this so long. Longer than Sybil has. So we already have a statute that says that when a landlord rejects an applicant, the landlord has to give the applicant, a statement generally describing the reason. You don't have to say specifically, I don't like you. But I get a lot of talks on our town law, and I often say, I hope I'm not offending someone here often say it's perfectly legitimate to discriminate against Oregon State Beaver fans. You can deny someone because
that's
they're an
wrong.
Oregon State Beaver
fan.
And you could put that down as your reason. But Leonard's also will tell you that they teach themselves that they should accept the first eligible applicant. So that they don't have to go back and say, well, I didn't take you because I was waiting for someone better, and just the fact that you were Catholic or black or whatever will then suggest inappropriate.
Follow-up, ma'am.
Follow-up.
Well, Mr. Van Lingenham, if I'm a renter or tenant, I own the property and I want to rent it, am I allowed to go get a background check that would turn up the DUIIs and things like that and still say that's my right? That's why I'm basing my rejection of you?
Chair Tomei and Representative Wisnett, and please jump in, but yes, and this bill specifically allows landlords to consider criminal history, to look at it, and then to make a determination based on whether that criminal history is related to their ability to be a good tenant. So yes, you would be able to do that background check, look at what it turns up, and then decide whether it meets the standard for you or not.
Then I'll just make a last statement that I guess I have a friend, I think I've told some of the people in this business this story, that she rents, has about 15 units in Bend that they rent, so, and we've rented periodically at times. And I said, well, how do you be sure you've got a good renter? And her policy is she asks the potential renter, what kind of vacuum cleaner you own?
That's a deal.
So is that a legitimate question? Refusal if they don't know what a vacuum cleaner is?
Note to self. Okay. Representative Gonberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask the panel to help me understand how an applicant family would fare under this measure if a member of the family were undocumented.
I think Chair Tomei, Representative Gonberg, it would have no impact. This bill would have no impact on that whatsoever.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so I'm referring to the memo that the coalition put together, and also I want to go back to Section 3, and it's kind of a follow-up of what we're Representative Wisnett was at, and it deals with the five-year piece. Okay, so my understanding is that a landlord is not able to consider any convictions outside of the five-year window.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, the five-year period only applies to prior FEDs, so evictions. Remember, there's three parts to this. You can't consider arrests at all. Can't consider eviction decisions, judgments by a court that are older than 5 years. The theory being that you've lived somewhere for the last 5 years and hopefully you've reestablished yourself. And then convictions, there's no time limit. Sybil used an example of saying DUIs that are 20 years old maybe not aren't relevant to a landlord. Again, what the tenants are hoping for is an individualized analysis where a landlord says, okay, I can look at your criminal record and history, and I can look at everything, but I can't consider things that don't seem relevant to your performance as a tenant going forward.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you. Sybil, you went really quickly over how many tenants and how they gave you feedback. I'm curious for all of your panels, Cindy's 1,700 people, how they weigh in, and I'm assuming it's probably not unanimous, so do you go with just a majority vote? I'm curious about how people feed into the system.
Madam Chair, Representative Kinnegar, nothing is unanimous, and I think that we don't have a hard and fast rule. We operate with a rough consensus. Mm-hmm. So two landlord groups out of three support this. I'm sure that some of their members don't support it. Mm-hmm. On my side, and the Community Alliance of Tenants, I think the Community Alliance of Tenants strongly supports this particular aspect. On my side, there are lawyers that I work with that think it is of no value. I have lawyers on my side that think that mandatory renter's insurance is the worst thing ever. So it is a compromise. And there's no other way to say that. And we don't quantify. We don't vote.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Yes. Oh, we're waiting for you.
Showtime. All right. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Gwen Baldwin, and I'm here today representing Multifamily Northwest. You may have had us before you with our prior iteration of Metro Multifamily Housing Association. And we changed our name specifically because we are a statewide organization representing over 150,000 units of rental housing, not only across Oregon, but including Southwest Washington. We do represent owners of thousands of units, but we also represent mom-and-pop operations with one or two rentals. Our petri dish is very diverse, and it produces incredibly interesting information and incredibly important opportunities to provide hundreds of classes and trainings on a wide array of issues, from landlord-tenant law to fair housing law to maintenance to best practices for renting and operating your business. We also produce the Apartment Report, which offers quarterly information on apartment rental rates across Oregon, as well as industry trends. And I say that by way of saying all this information and experience informs our work with the Landlord-Tenant Coalition. As Sean mentioned earlier, we've been participants in this coalition as a collective of landlords and tenants for decades, with that one exception of the 1 year we took a hiatus. And we know and appreciate the value of coming together. And every time is different, and the set of issues are different, and the challenges of coming to consensus are different. But that being said, Senate Bill 91A does represent a wide array of stakeholders, represents important housing issues, interests, and concerns. And as with any agreement, yes, we had to compromise. So did others. And in the end result, though, I think is a solid, important, positive bill that we hope you will support. One of the key issues in coalition for us, and John mentioned it earlier, was the clear ability to allow landlords to require renters liability insurance if it's expressly included in the rental agreement. It was important to our members. We brought it to coalition to ensure that we could address any concerns and avoid hashing things out in court and, frankly, in front of you. And so we recognize that as we came together with an issue, we listened and tried to address some of the concerns, whether it was the hardship of very low-income tenants that they might find even for what are, on average, very, very modest premiums. And so, you know, the end result wasn't what we came in with, but it's something that we can work with and live with. And the other one that I want to address, and I know we're all kind of focusing on this, is the criminal prior criminal history. And we came at from a slightly different point of view. And I know the governor's task force on criminal history has sort of struggled with this issue for years. I mean, we kept coming around and around and around on liability and around how do we draw a line? How do we create a bright line? Is it on year? Is it on criminal type? And frankly, one of the things that was really spectacular about this process was at a certain point, we kind of threw it all out and said, what is it that we're really trying to get at? And it wasn't about bright lines. It was about consideration. It was about being able to articulate what is important for your business, whether it's small or large, for the tenants that you already have and want to keep, and for the prospective tenants that you're bringing into that mix. How do you paint that picture? And frankly, the national discussion is all about bright lines. The national discussion heads toward protected class status for criminal convictions. That makes us very nervous because we do believe that if somebody has a criminal conviction, there may, and frequently is, an issue that we want to consider in terms of that rental. So with this particular bill, a landlord will be able to consider a prospective tenant's entire criminal conviction, period. But we have to create the standard on which those convictions sit. So I posit the sort of 20-year-ago thing because it's true. 20 years ago, it may be they've had spectacular, clear, conduct ever since. And, you know, there has to be some room for people, you know, getting better and doing better and not forever being punished by, their time served or their payment to society. At the same time, if that person who had a DUI or reckless driving at 20 had repeat references from other landlords who said they kept zooming through parking and they, you know, nearly hit a child and we had to talk to them again and again, it builds a painting that says this person still has some issues. It may not have, resulted in criminal conviction, but this pattern says not good fit. There's nothing in this bill that prohibits us from doing that. In fact, it quite specifically says we may consider these things. We look at it as an entirety and a picture. And frankly, it creates a defense for us. We live in a litigious society. Let's face it. We already face folks coming and saying, we believe that we weren't treated fairly for X, Y, and Z. And we have to be able to defend ourselves regardless of the size of our business. That's kind of one of the prices of business in this industry. And so I would rather have a set where I've said, you know, I am concerned about tenants who, prospective tenants who have demonstrated that they are disruptive or violent or have financial fraud or any number of other things that I've articulated my standard for my screening company, than to have somebody say, oh, you didn't accept me as a tenant. But I think the reason is this protected class or this status. And if I haven't articulated that standard, then I am vulnerable. And I think that this actually gives us and encourages the creation of that standard that protects us. So for all those reasons, we believe that Senate Bill 91A deserves your support, and we would strongly encourage you to send this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Baldwin. Any questions? Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Ms. Baldwin, I appreciate your testimony and your willingness to compromise and be a part of this. I want to get back to the size issue. You indicated you've got quite a variety in your coalition. I shouldn't say your coalition, in your portfolio.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how many are of a smaller size we were discussing in your group.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, it really kind of matters, depends on the area. We have chapters in the Willamette Valley and the Southern Willamette Valley and Central Oregon, as well as the Portland metro area. And depending on where, you know, our chapter is located, it's a different mix. But I would say we really kind of, we run the gamut. I mean, we have hundreds of members who are small, 10 units or less.
Follow up, Madam
Chair.
Thank you. I guess I'm still wondering about the question, regardless of how many different kinds you have in your group.
Mm-hmm.
What about the sensitivity to their difficulty, the small members in your group, of knowing what's going on, for lack of a better word? Wouldn't it be wise to take into account the smallness, the fact they're not on premise, the kind of things we heard, the disadvantages that they have, even if they're members of yours? Wouldn't there still be reason for discussion on a carve-out for smaller folk?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gillum, I agree with Cindy that as a general rule, we try to create a coalition bill that applies broadly, because the more we do carve-outs that actually creates more complexity. And I think that, you know, we certainly take very seriously our obligation to train and to educate. And we do that not only to our members, but those trainings and educations are open to all. Because that's an important part of it. I mean, there are not only state laws around landlord-tenant, but there are considerations at the local level. There are considerations at the federal level. And those considerations all exist regardless of the size. And while in some cases in federal statute, there's the Mrs. Murphy's rule of four units or less, Oregon determined some time ago that they were not going to follow the federal government in that, and that landlord-tenant law should apply across the board. So that dynamic already occurs in Oregon, and so we look at it as our responsibility to, when we come to coalition and come to agreement, to have it be something that can be workable for all sizes, recognizing that some of them will have more outreach and education, and we will need to do more training, and we will need to communicate in a different way.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it can be for any one of you three. In your discussions, did you really dig into the idea on the DUII portion of it, like maybe within a 10-year time period from conviction? Because obviously DUII is connected with, alcohol, and the majority of the stuff that we're talking about right now, this seems to get a person evicted faster than anything. It's alcohol driven.
Chair Tomei, Rep. Olson, we didn't discuss specifically the proposal that you made. We did look at whether we could create a bright line related to certain convictions past a certain age, and determined that that didn't work for us. It's very complicated and difficult to draft. It's difficult to get all of the convictions that you'd like to lump into what the right particular time frame was. And we also realized in looking at it that that might work for some but be inappropriate in others. And so we thought it made more sense to allow the landlord to use the standard and kind of make that assessment. So I don't know if anybody has anything else to add.
The short answer is no.
Okay.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming to testify to that. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 91A. Colleagues, I think probably we shouldn't vote on this today, and I will carry it over. We have a pretty full agenda on Wednesday, don't we?
We do.
So maybe we'll carry it over till next Monday. Do I need to do anything else to do that? I just stated that, right?
You did.
All right.
Good.
All right. Thank you. With that, we will open up and I close the. I did already close the public hearing. Did I close the public hearing, Debbie?
Yes.
Okay. I will open up the informational hearing on tobacco master settlement tobacco prevention. Thank you all for coming today. Hi there.
Child died of immune deficiency. And they're saying that this can be used to treat that.
But the sentence there?
They're using it to that's an option that they get in the hospital.
Look, it looks like we cleared the room.
I know. Good for you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Tauman. I'm a lawyer in Portland, and I'm here as president of the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon. And I suppose it's because I'm the oldest person that most of these people know that I was invited to give a bit of history of the Master Settlement Agreement. I'm not going to bore you with all of the details. In fact, it's easy to find out information about the Master Settlement Agreement. I've included in my written materials an excerpt from the some 200-page long agreement. It's only a few pages, but quite frankly, it's the most, to me, it's the most important pages, but it has no legally binding effect. It is the expression of both the states, including the state of Oregon, and the tobacco manufacturers, and it's entitled The Recitals. And it has a lot of flowery lawyer language, as do the other 200 pages. But this settlement agreement, which was entered into by the state of Oregon in 1998 and concluded litigation that had been prompted in every single state in the nation, litigation against all of the major tobacco companies, and litigation which accused the tobacco industry of fraud. and sought reimbursement for the expenses that each of these states had been forced to incur. This is the document that concluded that litigation, and most people know about the money. In many ways, in this building, it's the gift that keeps on giving. It does, because it goes on in perpetuity. The real question is not what the money comes in for, but what it goes out for. And according to the Master Settlement Agreement itself, under the recitals, it says, in order to further the settling states' policies regarding public health, including policies adopted to achieve a significant reduction in smoking by youth. It says that the states are committed to reducing underage tobacco use by discouraging such use and by preventing youth access to tobacco products. Further, the settling states' policies designed to reduce youth smoking to prevent public health are the focus of this agreement. And finally, the Master Settlement Agreement, according to its terms, will achieve for the settling states and their citizens significant funding for the advancement of public health, the implementation of important tobacco-related public health measures. And since that time in 1998, and since the payment started flowing every year in April, not one penny of that money has been spent for tobacco prevention purposes. This little brief history of something that happened many, many years ago, I think, is important because agreements like this that were entered into by a state is not only an agreement between the parties, but it's really a promise to the citizens of that state. The people who signed this agreement were representatives of the state of Oregon. And since that time, every year, the state of Oregon has enjoyed, this legislature has enjoyed, the revenue that comes from this agreement year after year after year, and yet not once have they voted to comply with the agreement, at least the spirit of the agreement, by committing any of that money to tobacco prevention purposes.
Mr. Thomas, tell us how much money that is per year.
Well, cumulatively, as of the April payment, it's over $1 billion. And it's in perpetuity, so it will come in year after year, long after. Certainly, I've gone from the scene here, so it's something that can be depended on.
So, are we violating a federal agreement that we agreed when we agreed to the settlement that we would agree that we would develop policies adopted to achieve a significant reduction in smoking by youth?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, it would be hard to say that we are, certainly it can't be said we're violating a federal agreement. The federal government was not a signatory to this agreement. The state of Oregon was an agreement. The federal government has other ways of pressuring, forcing, cajoling, insisting that we spend money in a certain way. So this is an agreement from the sovereign state of Oregon. The real question is whether we are violating this agreement, and I would assert that we're certainly violating the spirit of this agreement. And in those heady days, it seems like a century ago, and of course it was in the last, or really in the last millennium that this was signed, the fact is that everyone, the public celebration of this settlement was the fact that the tobacco industry had finally been held accountable for their some 50 years of fraud that they had committed, and that now we were going to go to work and solve the problem with the payments, the problem that had been created by that fraud, with the payments that were going to be coming in every year, year after year. And that's the promise that was broken. Unfortunately, we have no one to blame but ourselves because, as the members of the committee know, the legislature has full custody and control of this money, can do anything they want with it, and that's one of the criticisms, is that there were no restrictions in the master settlement agreement itself. Probably there wouldn't have been a master settlement agreement if the money had been in some way restricted or required. The states didn't want that. They just wanted money. The tobacco industry didn't want that because they knew that the states would not have the political will to commit, and with few exceptions, it's accurate that they have not committed a penny of this money to tobacco prevention. Thank you.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I have a few questions. One is, are there states that have done a better job than others? It looks like none have designated any for tobacco specifically. That's one question. The other is, my understanding is that the reason that over the last 10 years it hasn't been up for grabs is because it was committed to pay back general obligation bonds. Is that, in fact, not really the case? Because although those bonds were issued, we could have used other sources for that. And thirdly, we're supposed to put 1% aside for Department of Justice. Do you, in your opinion, I know this is up for, you know, for discussion right now in the legal realm, but in your opinion, are we at risk for losing it because of past decisions?
Oh, boy. A lot of questions. Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, thank you for the questions, and there may be others in our panel that are better equipped to answer them, so I'll answer them briefly, and others can join in now. The real question is whether I can remember them. Trying to take them backwards because those are the ones that I remember, though. The 1% is for committed to the Department of Justice is for enforcement of the laws that were required to be passed under the Master Settlement Agreement, which, by the way, the state of Oregon has done a great job in doing. And that, as you may know, is the subject of the current arbitration that's taking place as we speak in Chicago, which may have a downward effect on the amounts of the payments. Have other states been doing a better job? Yes. The answer is yes. For instance, in the state of Florida, they had an initiative that was proposed and voted on by the people, which committed the funding for the Master Settlement Agreement to tobacco prevention. And so, therefore, Florida was a bit of an exception because it's settled separately. It's not technically part of the Master Settlement Agreement, but they had a similar agreement. There are other states that have committed on an ongoing basis some percentage of the Master Settlement Agreement money to tobacco control. You can count them, I believe, on one hand, or certainly on two hands, the states in the United States that have followed the real spirit of the Master Settlement Agreement. I think there was a question in the middle, but I've totally lost that.
You have another question?
I did, and I lost it at all.
We'll come back to it. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with what you said overall, but I was going to bring up the same thing. We have done enforcement of being sure they're not selling to underage, and I thought along with that there was some money funded for going to schools and talk about the not smoking, and I thought we also had a lot of public service announcements. I don't know if that was federally or state, but I agree overall. I'm not trying to disagree with your comment. Not a penny was spent.
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, as I said, others can probably speak better to this. There is money to prevent retail outlets to sell tobacco to underage. It does not come from the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement or even from the general fund. It is money that comes from the federal government under the what's called the Sinar Amendment, which is a subject that the legislature treated last session. The money that comes to us that funds the public service announcements comes partly from the general fund through the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program and partly from the federal government. When we see advertisements, some of them originate in the from the CDC, and some of them originate from our local the state TPEP program.
One just quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Does your organization have a position on the electrical, whatever they're called, electric cigarettes or something?
We do not, and it's a very controversial subject. They are nicotine-containing devices, and they are addictive. They don't contain tar, and so it's a very controversial subject.
Kenny Gar, you had another question?
Well, I just remembered the middle question was the issuance of the bonds and how people felt that we had made a 10-year commitment to that, which is just ending now. In your opinion, is that in fact not really the case? Because we could have covered those bonds with other funds and returned to the original intent of this.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, I think that that's a technical question that has to do with the way bonds are sold by committing a known stream of income to the service of those bonds. And so I believe that the state was able to achieve a lower interest rate by, instead of making them general obligation bonds, making them bonds that were serviced by a specific fund of money. Now, it's all general fund money, so you're certainly correct that those bonds could have still been sold and the state could have still achieved its commitment to the agreement.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Thomas-Wheat, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Heart Association and Stroke Association in Oregon. And the American Heart Association is the nation's oldest, largest voluntary organization devoted to fighting heart disease and stroke. And we fund innovative research, fight for stronger public health policies, and provide critical tools and information to save and improve lives. Our mission is to build healthier lives free of cardiovascular diseases and stroke. I think just even listening to this conversation, which has been very brief already, it's interesting to me that tobacco brings up a lot of different things in people's minds. There's taxes, MSA, I mean, especially even in this legislative session, working in this building now, there's a lot of different conversations happening around tobacco and around cigarettes, and a lot of them are very important. And I just want to mention, really reiterate the point that Chuck is making, that there's been a lot of money invested in this state, and it's come from tobacco companies. And, kind of our key message has been that not one penny of those funds have been spent on tobacco prevention. And I think it's really important to make sure that that message, kind of rises to the top to make sure that we're really having the public's integrity and trust in this legislative body in remembering that agreement and remembering that intent. And that, many of our organizations are here to make sure that those funds are spent as they were intended. And I'm going to kind of jump around just in response a little bit to the questions there, but in the testimony that I provided, the last sheet has a little pie chart, and it has the tobacco settlement allocations from 1999 to 2013, so it includes the funds that are coming in for this coming biennium. And it's really dark. I apologize for that with the copier that I used. So I did send that to Regina, and so it's available online, too. So if you look at it on your computer, it should be a little bit easier. But you can see here how those settlement funds have been spent over the last decade. So there's the debt service on general obligation bonds. That's the largest piece. There's a section there that has been spent on OHP in the health division. That was for the health expansions. And then there's debt service general obligation funds. So just have that as your reference, and then I can come back to it in my testimony. But taking us back, I guess, a little bit higher level again, heart disease is the number one killer of all Oregonians, and tobacco use is the number one cause of heart disease. I think each one of us in this room has likely been touched by tobacco. We know somebody who is addicted to cigarettes. We ourselves have been, a smoker. We all have our individual stories. I know for myself, I have never been a smoker, but my husband, who I love very dearly, I've known for over a decade, we've been married 6 years, and he got addicted to smoking when he was
in high school, and was a smoker when we met, and I hated it, and basically said, you know, I'm not going to get married, and I'm not going to live in the same household, I'm not going to raise kids with a smoker, and had to watch and work with him to quit tobacco, and it's super, super challenging. He's hasn't had a cigarette for 8 years, and I'm super proud of him, but that's a constant challenge, and I think each of us has our own story, either ourselves, someone that we know, someone that we love, who's been successful at kicking tobacco, or unfortunately has faced the consequences and the long-term diseases that is associated with tobacco. So, like I said, there's a lot of discussions around tobacco prevention. I wanted to talk about this Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement and really the campaign effort that we've been a part of as the Heart Association, along with many, many other organizations. So also included in my testimony is this one-pager that hopefully many of you have seen. I know you guys see a lot of one-pagers in your boxes, but hopefully this is not totally unfamiliar to you. On the side here, you'll see a list of many organizations, many of our most respected organizations in this state, the Cancer Society, Diabetes, Heart and Lung Association, Coalition of Local Health Officials, Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Latino Health Coalition, Northwest Health Foundation, many others, Medical Association on here. These are really the folks that we trust to look out for our populations, to do the right thing. We're unbiased, you know, in our assessments. As the Heart Association, all of our positions are taken based on extensive research and science, and any policy position that we take has to be backed up by research papers, by documents that are put together by researchers and scientists. So from the Heart Association's perspective, you know, this is really about doing the right thing. This is really about making the best choice for our communities. So we have been working with a group of these folks to kind of track this use of the Tobacco Master Settlement Funds. As Chuck referenced, we've been getting the funds for about the last decade, and not none of those funds have been spent on tobacco prevention. They've been spent on other things, largely this large chunk going to the general obligation bonds, which the bulk of which is retiring this year. So that would free up, and Chair Tomei had asked earlier as far as the amount per biennium. Looking forward, starting in 2013, it'll be about $120 million a biennium. The next biennium, 2015-2017, there'll be another smaller bond that will be retiring. It's about $29 million, so that will increase that percentage of the available funds moving forward as well. House Bill 2136, there is a bill that has been tracking this issue, and that is 2136, and it passed out of the House Healthcare Committee, and it's been sent to the Ways and Means. That bill basically addresses the funding aspect of the Tobacco Master Settlement Funds, and it would dedicate 10% of the available TMSA funds towards tobacco prevention and education through the TURA account, which is the Tobacco Use Reduction Account, which is the account that supports the programs that do tobacco prevention in our state. The remaining 90% would go to the Oregon Health Authority. So there, that bill, like I said, has moved out of the House Healthcare Committee and is in Ways and Means and is being considered by that committee. In addition to the 10% discussion that's being talked about in that bill, our campaign is really asking that all of these funds be dedicated towards health and wellness activities, and that is largely in keeping, again, with the intent of the original agreement of preventing chronic diseases with the particular focus on youth. So I just wanted to kind of highlight the pieces of our proposal to you, and it's in the statement that I have, but there's the first piece, which is contributing our recommendation is to help support the health system's transformation efforts. Oregon has been doing phenomenal work in this regard. We're leading the country, and we want to make sure that we're successful in continuing that. So we have that. We also have a portion that would dedicate funds towards children's health and wellness. It's interesting, more and more research is coming out that looks at the fact that health does not happen in silos. So usually if a person is healthy in one area, they're more likely to be healthy in another. So we know that if a kid is empowered to say no to tobacco, they're more likely to eat healthy and to stand up to a bully and do these types of things. So we are asking for investments in children's health and wellness. And then the $12 million, which is the 10% of the current allocation of TMSA funds, $12 million would go to reducing smoking in Oregon. So kind of coming full swing again back to talk about tobacco, and I also you know, I know that the there are two people here specifically from the tobacco prevention programs to speak about what they do and what the impacts of tobacco are. So I didn't include a lot of that in my testimony, but every year tobacco kills 7,000 Oregonians, an additional 800,000 die from secondhand smoke. This is a major issue for our state. I mean, we talk about tobacco a lot. We hear about it kind of in the back of our minds. I think it's been something that is just out there all the time that it's easy to forget about how devastating it really is for our communities. You know, when we start thinking about budget numbers and big things, you know, the idea of 7,000 people dying because of this choice that they make every day can get overlooked, but I think it cannot be overlooked, and we need to pay attention. Using current smoking rates, 74,000 kids now under 18 and alive in Oregon will ultimately die prematurely from smoking. That's another really concerning statistic. And the number one way to cut the cost of tobacco-related diseases is to make sure a kid never picks up a cigarette. That's the absolutely best way to make sure it never happens. And if they do become addicted, it's to help them stop. And we have some phenomenal programs in the state who are doing that work, helping educate people about the dangers of tobacco, preventing them from ever becoming addicted, and then helping them quit if, unfortunately, they do get addicted to that product. So we really have a great program in the state. They're active in every single county, in all of your districts, in all of your cities. They are doing the hard work of sharing the information about tobacco and making sure that people are well informed. These programs are effective. They reach youth, they reach our families, they reach our communities, and they also have a huge return on investment. For every dollar spent on tobacco interventions, the state of Oregon realizes a return of investment of $5 from reductions in tobacco-related costs. So this is it's not only a health issue, it's an economic issue for our state, and particularly with all the discussions around health transformation, this is something we need to be front-loading. And just last, a small point is the public supports this. There was a poll done late last summer in August 2012 that was talking specifically about the Master Settlement Funds, and it showed that 85% of Oregonians favor dedicating at least 10% of the Oregon settlement money to tobacco prevention programs. 85% of Oregonians support this. This is something that is hugely supported by our communities, and we just need the political will to make sure that we're investing in it. So I know this is an informational hearing, and I appreciate you know, you letting me speak to the dangers of tobacco and to the different kinds of moving pieces out there, and I'm happy to respond to any questions. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you, Chair Tomei, for bringing this to our and Representative Gomberg for bringing this to the committee today.
Thank you. Any questions? So, Stephanie, talk to us about the prevention programs with children. Is anyone else? I know we have several people who are going to be speaking today. Is that something you can address, or should I ask somebody else?
I can. I would probably have, I know Sarah Hartstein, I think,
okay,
if I'm pronouncing
right.
that right, is from Benton
right.
County, and she
right.
actually manages one of the programs,
okay.
So it would be great if she could speak about
Perfect.
What she's doing with there.
Okay, will do. Any other questions? Thank you so much. So now we'll call up Mel Cohn, Sarah Hartstein, and Sarah Bessler. Good to see you, Mel. And you're going to have a little slideshow presentation for us.
Good afternoon, everybody. For the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the Director of Public Health for the state at the Oregon Health Authority and the State Public Health Officer. And Chair Tomei, Representative Gomberg, members of the committee, I'm really delighted to have an opportunity to talk to you this afternoon about the incredible work that our tobacco prevention and education program has done over the years. And I want to call out Kirsten Aird, who's sitting very quietly in the background there, as many of our staff do, that really she's been a terrific help in putting together this presentation and all the work that TPEP does. So So I think when you think about our program, and Representative Wisnant, some of the things that you were talking about are things that our TPEC program does. We really have two primary goals. One is helping people quit smoking and at the same time helping kids so that they don't start smoking in the first place. As Stephanie said, that really is the best kind of prevention. But I think in this day and age of health reform, it's really important to emphasize that the TPEP program really supports the triple aim. You know, it improves health statewide. Tobacco-related diseases are incredibly expensive. And it improves care, because when we're not spending all that time and energy and resource on tobacco-related diseases, we can spend it on other things to improve health. This is a graph that shows the per capita cigarette consumption, or rather sales, in Oregon versus the rest of the U.S. And what you can see in the blue line is consumption in Oregon, starting in 1993 and running until 2011. And in the dotted line, that's in the rest of the United States. And what you can see is that before our tobacco prevention program started, Oregon was a little bit higher in terms of tobacco use than the rest of the country. And if I had extended this graph even earlier, you would see that pattern continuing. But once Measure 44 passed, and Measure 44 increased the tax on cigarettes 30 cents a pack, 3 cents of which is dedicated to this TURA account that funds the activities of TPEP. There are some additional tobacco taxes, incidentally, that currently in Oregon, the tax is, I believe, $1.18 a pack. Oregon is one of, I believe, two states, or perhaps even the only state in the country, where in recent years our tobacco taxes have actually dropped because of a sunset on a tobacco tax that we had. At any rate, you can see that once the program started, the slope of the line changed pretty dramatically, and we really started to drive down tobacco use here in Oregon. And then in 2003, Representative Tomei, I believe you were here in the legislature at that time. I'm not sure others. Representative Olson, were you here at that point?
2003.
Negative.
Okay, so, you know, Representative Wisnant, that's right, you were here.
At the end of it.
You will remember that we had a very severe financial crisis at that time, and during the session, the funding for TPEP was cut initially to zero. At that time, our program was very heavily dependent on contracts that we had through our county health department coalitions that you're going to hear some more about in a few minutes. And so staff were let go. It really decimated the program. And so, not surprisingly, this very dramatic drop that we had seen in tobacco consumption really started, the line started to change again. And, you know, the tobacco industry is actively promoting these products. So if there isn't something pushing back in the other direction, it's really not surprising that the curve started to flatten out there. And in fact, in some subgroups, particularly pregnant women, tobacco use is associated with premature births. And, you know, subsequently, if moms are continuing to smoke around their kids, all kinds of health problems in the kids. But in pregnant women, we actually saw a small increase in tobacco use in that period after the dollars were cut. At the very end of the session, the small portion of them, of those dollars, were restored to about a third of the prior amount of funding that we have. Then back up to the voter-approved Measure 44 level, you can see there in 2007. Again, once we were funded again, you can see the line starting to drop again.
Doctor, when did we pass the law about not smoking in restaurants? Did that have an impact?
Representative Wisnant, Chair Tomei, I can't tell you off the top of my head, but it
2007.
Okay.
And it went down.
Yes. I think that was a very important landmark piece of legislation and terrific leadership by this body. Absolutely. Very, very important. The experience that we've had here in Oregon that our success in dropping tobacco use is linked to funding is not unique. Every state where this has happened has seen exactly this same thing. So, if we really want to drive down tobacco use, we've got to fund these programs. The Centers for Disease Control recommends that Oregon be funded at about $44 million a year for tobacco prevention. We are currently funded at about $8.5 million a year. But even with that amount of funding, we are able to substantially make a difference, I think, in this very, very serious health problem. So we know that since 1996, when ballot measure 44 passed, with that 3 cents a pack going to prevention, adult smoking prevalence has declined 14%, 11th grade smoking prevalence 57%, and 8th grade smoking declined 74%. And we know that the rate of deaths linked to tobacco is also declining. So we are making some progress in this effort. But we still know that tobacco is the leading preventable cause of death and illness in Oregon. We have, as has already been mentioned, about 7,000 deaths a year. That's almost a quarter of the deaths that we have in Oregon are due to tobacco, and $2.4 billion in direct medical expenditures and lost productivity from people dying early. And this happens every year, every year. So this is an enormous toll and drag on our economy, on our healthcare system, and on our communities. Now I want to talk a little bit about what TPEP does and how we approach this work. You know, tobacco is a very addictive substance. Stephanie told the story about her husband. That's not at all unusual. We know that people who start younger have much more difficult time quitting when they've been smoking for a long time. There's a whole set of social rituals as well as some biological things that happen that make this a very, very difficult habit to stop. But, you know, if you go to the doctor, and I'm a doctor, so I can say this, and your doctor tells you to quit smoking, you may or may not listen to him or her, or maybe you'd listen to him or her for a little while, but what really is going to keep you off of tobacco is the reinforcement of those messages around you in the community. The smoke-free workplace law is a great example of that, because when you go back to work, you get this message that it's not okay for you to be smoking. When you go home and your kids razz you because they learned about tobacco in school, and your wife tells you that, you know, you got to go step outside and smoke because she doesn't like it in the house and it's raining outside, this is Oregon after all of that reinforces this change in social norms and values. And so we see our role at the program level at the state to try to support those kinds of changes across the board. We call this a comprehensive approach to tobacco prevention. And we do this in partnership with our colleagues at local health departments around the state, and I know Sarah's going to talk some more about that. You can see here we do fund programs in every county and also in all of the federally recognized tribes here in Oregon. And that's what some of that TURA funding goes for, as well as the other things like media and tracking the rates of tobacco and so forth. So I want to give you some examples of some of the initiatives that are going on. We know that communities funded by TPEP are helping families. One of the things when the smoke-free workplace law passed, this is a law that's enforced by complaint. In other words, if you are in a workplace and someone is smoking, you call it in and we have a whole process to investigate this, and ultimately there are actually fines that can be levied. Most of the time we don't have to go that far. But one of the most common complaints we got was there were people in multi-unit housing apartments. Someone was smoking in the hallway or in the apartment next door, and they wanted us to do something about it. Well, that's not a workplace, right? But it turns out that there are ways that landlords can potentially pass policies to address this. It's perfectly legal for them to do so, and actually there's all kinds of economic benefits for them to do so, because tobacco destroys their property in a variety of ways. You know, risk of fire and burns in the carpet and so forth. So we've been working with landlords and housing authorities across the state to establish smoke-free properties, and you can see some of our collaborators here from the Salem Housing Authority. Representative Tomei, you asked about kids, and I know that my other speakers are going to speak a little bit more about that. One of the places that we've been thinking about and working on a lot with our coalitions around the state is tobacco-free parks, playgrounds, and community events that help keep kids away from secondhand smoke. And you can see here the Roseburg City Council decided Monday to ban smoking and chewing tobacco from all Roseburg parks with the exception of this golf course. So again, this is part of this changing the environment so that it reinforces this method. And, you know, if you're trying to quit smoking and you're around other smokers, it can be very, very difficult to smell that smoke and see it. Another example from Umatilla County, the Umatilla County Fair, obviously a really wonderful event in that community. There's no longer going to be exposure to secondhand smoke. The fairgrounds are smoke-free. This is a local decision, and I think, you know, really a terrific step forward for that community. You can see here the Helix 4-H Club members who asked the fair board to do this, so involving youth in this effort, also really, really terrific.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Doctor, do these laws about, you know, in the 10 feet away from a restaurant, things like that, will they apply to marijuana smoking, too?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnant, I don't believe that they do. I believe it's just tobacco. So Sarah's telling me that they do not. She's on the ground, so she knows the answer to that. I'm sure she's had that question come.
So you could smoke, if you had a medical marijuana card, you could smoke marijuana in a restaurant?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnant, I believe that is correct.
Thank you.
We also are working to make the state of Oregon properties tobacco-free because, you know, we feel like we have to walk the walk and not just talk the talk. Again, this is a very addictive substance. When we work to make these environments tobacco-free, we're very careful. We don't want to be demonizing smokers. We want to be setting up conditions so that people can quit and stay off tobacco. So this is a very successful effort that we've been working with the governor's office. And in January of 2013, State of Oregon properties are going to be going smoke-free, tobacco-free, excuse me. And then, finally, this is another very interesting project that we've worked on. When you look at the disparity in tobacco use, you find that people who have lower incomes, for example, people who earn under $15,000 a year, smoke at about three times the rate of people who earn more than $45,000 a year. There are a lot of reasons for that, but we know that this is a group that deserves some special attention and help. And so we have been working very hard, collaborating with folks in other agencies within the state, particularly the Department of Human Services, which touches the lives of low-income people every day in providing services, to incorporate some tobacco prevention efforts into their work. This is one example. When we approached the Seniors and People with Disabilities group, they said, well, you know, actually our home care workers are low-income people because they don't earn very much money, and in fact they have a very high rate of tobacco use. It was interesting for me as a data person, often there's a matching of clients who smoke with home care workers who smoke to try to make this a harmonious arrangement. And so they actually had a database that allowed them to know what percentage of their home care workers smoked, and this was very useful for us to evaluate this. So we worked with the Home Care Commission and the home care workers and very, very successful collaboration to reach low-income Oregonians.
Representative Gallegos, do you have a question?
Yeah, I just had a question, I suppose. I mean, I remember some years ago coming across data that indicated the literally marketing, tobacco companies were marketing to communities of color, and I don't know if that continues to be the case. The other thing I'm thinking about in terms of what you're just speaking of is the fact that, you know, cigarette smoking is at least thought to be a de-stressor, and certainly with low income and as a mental health kind of issue, it seems to me to that's another reason why we see it so prevalent in those communities.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, that's absolutely right. There is a lot of very direct marketing to communities of color as well as low-income communities. And, you know, we know on average that, for example, people with chronic mental illness die about 25 years earlier than people without chronic mental illness. I think in my book that's about the biggest health disparity I can possibly think of. That's not all due to tobacco, but tobacco is a very substantial contributor to that. So we have been collaborating with the Addictions and Mental Health Division to work on this issue. As you say, from a standpoint of dealing with anxiety and stress, nicotine is a very good drug, but there are obviously a whole lot of other complications that go along with it. So, okay, so with that, I think I'm going to stop and turn the microphone over to Sarah.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
I just want to say, usually we end about this time, but when we decided that we would not have meetings anymore on Fridays, we did talk about having longer meetings today on Mondays and Wednesdays. So, we're certainly going to be hearing from these folks, and we will entertain questions.
Is that a signed contract? We don't.
It is a signed contract.
No,
yes.
That was this right here.
President Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question. Going back to your slide with the table, and we had the national rate and we had the Oregon rate. I noticed that table concluded in 2011, but it showed an uptick where we actually, for the first time in about a dozen years, had exceeded the national average. In 2012. Did that trend continue, or did we drop back down? Where do we stand now?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gomberg, I think that has continued to go downward, so it's sort of inflected again in a downward direction. But, you know, the money that TPEP is getting, with the exception of the period when it was defunded, has basically been pretty flat over the years. And, of course, there's inflation and other kinds of counter or pro-tobacco marketing that are going on. Perhaps it's not as powerful an effect as we had before. It's a little early to tell. I wouldn't put a whole lot of, I wouldn't interpret a whole lot from that little uptick right there. But we do track these rates very, very carefully so that we can know what's going on in the state. That we take at the state as one of our primary functions to track the rates of tobacco use.
I'm glad you asked that. I noticed that also, and I'm sure we'll be hearing about smoking in young people. I understand that there's an uptick in smoking among teenagers, so I'm anxious to hear from you.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, Vice Chairs Olson and Gomberg, and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Hartstein, and I'm the Benton County Tobacco Prevention Coordinator. And I have to tell you, Representative Tomei, Representative Wisnett, I misnodded. I believe medical marijuana, if you have a card, you may only use inside your home, not in bars, restaurants, etc. It only enters into my tobacco world every once in a while when we're dealing with no smoking rules and multi-unit properties. But it has been a concern lately for us when we see Colorado and Washington and what that would mean for us here. And so we've certainly looked at that at a local level.
Thank you.
I'm here to talk more about our local work as a part of the Oregon Comprehensive Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the plight of tobacco use in my community and what the Benton County Health Department is doing to prevent youth from smoking and to support adults who are trying to quit and protect non-smokers from exposure to secondhand smoke. Tobacco use inflicts a tremendous toll on the people who live in my county. In 1 year, 7,456 adults regularly smoke cigarettes, and close to 2,000 people suffer from a serious illness caused by tobacco use. 18% of all deaths in Benton County are due to tobacco use, even though we have among the lowest tobacco use rates in the state. This, to me, is a huge amount. Each year, we spend $17 million in Benton County on medical care for tobacco-related illnesses, and it's estimated that we spend $15 million in lost productivity due to tobacco-related deaths. I share these statistics with you as a reminder that tobacco use is still an issue that needs attention in our local communities. That being said, tobacco use rates in Oregon have declined, as you saw, due in large part to Oregon's evidence-based tobacco prevention and education program efforts at the state and the local levels. Public health research shows that a well-funded community prevention program like the TPEP program will continue to be an important part of the solution to further decrease tobacco use rates. This would be especially effective in concert with a fully transformed healthcare system, which focuses on saving lives and costs through community prevention. So the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program, all county health departments in Oregon, as you heard, receive funding for local tobacco prevention efforts. Funding for the TPEP comes from the Tobacco Use Reduction Account, or TURA as you know it. The TURA receives 3 cents of the $1.18 that is collected in cigarette taxes and 4.26% of other tobacco taxes, including cigars. These funds are essential for ensuring that there are community efforts in tobacco prevention across Oregon, from Portland to Klamath Falls, Newport to Albany to Ontario. The TPEP program has been particularly impactful in my county. In Benton County, there have been many examples of local work that protects residents from secondhand smoke and prevents youth from smoking. One significant example, due in part to health department staffing provided through TPEP funds, occurred when the city of Corvallis was the first in Oregon to pass a comprehensive smoke-free workplace ordinance in 1997. This was 12 years before the comprehensive state law went into place. In 2005, Corvallis implemented smoke-free parks. And more recently, staff worked with the Benton County Board of Commissioners to develop and implement a tobacco-free government property policy that includes our parks, natural areas, and our fairgrounds. Staff also assisted Samaritan Health Services and Oregon State University as they developed and implemented their tobacco-free and smoke-free policies, respectively, which are designed to reduce secondhand smoke exposure and tobacco use prevalence. While working closely with the Lynn Benton Housing Authority, we were able to establish no smoking rules for the 192 rental housing units, which protects children from smoke exposure and creates an environment where people are not smoking in the home. In addition to policy work, in Benton County, we partner with local law enforcement, retailers, and our substance abuse prevention program to train our alcohol and tobacco retailers on the current no sales to minors laws and provide them with the skills they need to comply. I would like to also share a couple of success stories from other communities. It's not just Benton County that's doing this work. There are successes in every county all over the state. And as I've already mentioned, these policies protect residents from secondhand smoke, support adults who are trying to quit, and help prevent youth from smoking. Coos County has recently worked with Southwestern Oregon Community College to implement a no-smoking campus policy. Deschutes County implemented a tobacco-free policy on all county properties recently. Lynn County worked with the City of Lebanon to pass a smoke-free parks policy. And Washington County worked with the multi-unit housing providers to adopt no-smoking rules. And this has resulted in 75% of the multi-unit housing stock in Washington County going smoke-free. There are many more examples like these from across the state. The state has a really nice spreadsheet that highlights them all. Smoke-free and tobacco-free policies are one of the most effective strategies to protect people from secondhand smoke and have been found to reduce both smoking prevalence and the amount of cigarettes that an individual smokes per day. A smoke-free environment also alters the perceived norms related to smoking by changing attitudes concerning the social acceptability of smoking, and youth are certainly impacted by this as well. Thank you for your time and for allowing me to speak to the committee about this important issue.
Thank you, Sarah. Sarah, are there any programs that are going on in schools?
There are not currently. Our funding, as it is right now, really focuses on policy, so creating smoke-free environments, tobacco-free environments. It also looks at system change, so looking at being able to better connect individuals to, for example, cessation support.
Right, I can appreciate that. I think mm-hmm. one of the issues we're really interested in here is yes. prevention, and we want to prevent kids from mm-hmm. starting, and so it seems to me that it's great to have the example of not smoking in a mm-hmm. park or in the workplace, et cetera, et cetera. But it's important to get to kids in school, so it sounds like there are no programs going on in schools right now. Is that correct? That anybody knows of?
Not that I know of. And if we look at the socio-ecological model, and this is what public health nerds talk about all the time, the education piece is most likely being done by health teachers in school. But when we look at really
how many schools have health teachers?
I'm not sure that I can answer
Pardon?
That.
It's required in middle and high school. It's yeah. a required subject.
Required to have health education, but is there a specific health teacher?
Yes.
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 Okay, thank you. Okay. Dr. Cohn?
Chair Tomei, I might add that, you know, we used to have a more robust right. Presence mm-hmm. in schools, but because of mm-hmm. the limitations of our funding, we haven't been able to continue, you know, do as much of that as we might like. When we think about among the different options, you know, where to allocate the limited funding that we have, we rely on the best practices that the Centers for Disease Control have researched and put out, and you know, we have to kind of pair that with the reality of how much money we have and where to best allocate it. So you know, I think this has been an area that probably deserves some more funding in mm-hmm. the future, but we're not able to do it now. And I guess one other thing that I think is very striking about Oregon, when we did some focus groups around our media campaigns early on in the TPEP program, one of the things we learned is that Oregon children listen to adults around them and model the behaviors they see in adults around them. I'm sort of smiling because that's not true quite so much in every other state. So it is a way that I think we have tried to tailor our work. You know, if we get the adults around kids to be modeling these behaviors, it's a very, very powerful message to our youth.
I can appreciate that. Professor Gelser, I'd really be interested in maybe if you know somebody who teaches perhaps in the middle school who might be willing to come to talk with us about the kind of prevention programs they're doing in their health classes.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd be glad to ask. It might be difficult for them since they're teaching at school at the time that we're here. But I mean, I've got two middle schoolers who do health twice a week. They complain about it. But they do it, and I know in high school as well, you're required to have both a health one and a health two, so two credits in health.
And so maybe between four and five, well. A Salem teacher.
Yes, perhaps a Salem teacher might be willing to do that. And my memory is that it's important to get to kids early on, that high school is really too late. By then, if they're going to start smoking, they probably started smoking. Is that correct, Dr. Cohn?
Chair Tomei, the middle school is really the key years,
right.
and a lot of our programs target middle schoolers.
Yeah.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So in recent years, was there a time when there was a TPEP-funded prevention program in elementary school? I seem to recall something with a clicker and my kids in elementary school. Am I...
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, that's not ringing a bell for me, but I'll go back and ask.
Back in a previous century, I used to teach in the prevention programs in an elementary school, in Portland Public Schools, a child development specialist, and we taught the classes regarding, I think it was called 2001, this was in the, way back in the 90s, but then, as I recall, then the use of tobacco in kids really went down, and we taught it early before the kids got into middle school and certainly before high school. And it was a very effective program, and it's very disappointing, I think, that we don't have anything like that now. All right, Sarah.
All right. I will try to be very brief.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here actually during National Nurses Week to highlight the urgent need for tobacco prevention, cessation, and health promotion programs that are included in the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement campaign proposal that you've heard a little bit about today. ONA represents over 13,000 nurses, nurse practitioners, and nursing students all over the state. And a key component of our healthcare agenda and our healthcare focus is a focus on prevention. And that's part of the reason that we've been so engaged in the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement campaign. As you've heard, tobacco use is widely known to cause a number of bad health outcomes and chronic diseases. And this happens despite the best intentions and efforts of every nurse and healthcare provider to help smokers quit. We simply must be doing more to prevent people from starting to smoke in the first place, and the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement presents us an opportunity to do that. Prevention is, as you've already heard, the most effective tool, especially for youth. Prevention is tied to better health outcomes and also at a much lower cost than helping someone who's already addicted quit. In the TMSA campaign proposal is really hinges on a focus.
I'm sorry, you haven't stated your name.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sarah Basler with the Oregon Nurses Association.
Thank you, Sarah.
So our proposal highlights prevention through the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program, through physical education in schools, through enhanced funding for school-based health centers, and through tobacco cessation through health systems transformation. You asked a few minutes ago about reaching youth, and there's a statistic that 9 out of 10 smokers have started smoking by the time they're 18 years old. Additionally, every day that we delay investing in tobacco prevention, 4,200 Oregon children under the age of 18 begin smoking. Often it's those kids who go on to be longtime smokers facing the health and economic consequences personally as well as in their communities. We included physical education in this proposal not just because, PE is great for a lot of reasons. I think first people think about it in terms of obesity prevention, which is another public health epidemic. But moderate levels of fitness have been shown to have a protective effect against other poor health decisions. So teens with low physical activity are more likely to smoke, use drugs, and have lower academic achievement. And so that, we spent a lot of time developing this proposal and really felt the PE part of it was a critical component. Because of that, as well as the general tie between better fitness and better health. Children who develop healthy lifestyles and habits at a younger age are far more likely to lead healthy lives, and PE and school-based health centers are one way to start them out on that path. You've already heard about the high costs of tobacco to the state and to people who use those products. And I want to just wrap it up by saying that the legislature is facing a significant opportunity to invest and honor the intent of the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement by focusing some of these dollars on tobacco prevention. The package of investments that you've heard outlined today can make a huge difference for kids who will never start smoking and who will lead healthier lives, and for adults who need help quitting. So thank you for this opportunity, and thank you especially to Chair Tomei and Representative Gomberg for inviting us to have this hearing. And I'm just a couple minutes over 5 o'clock.
You're doing great. Any quick questions? Thank you all so much. And colleagues, we'll try to invite a middle school teacher from the Salem area to come and give us some information about the health classes they teach and if they talk about tobacco use.
I would recommend somebody from Silverton. They're close, too.
That would be. You want to follow up with that? That would
Happy
be great.
To.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay. With that, any further questions? Thank you all so much. And with that, we will close the informational meeting regarding the Tobacco Master Settlement and Tobacco Prevention, and we'll close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you, committee. And so do